Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next, a dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Hi, this is What's Next, and I am your guest host, Ekou Amenzedu of Clementine Gold Group. Today, I am super excited to be talking with you, Colleen Christich, Senior Community Researcher at Partnership for the Public Good, and Alia Williams, Social Worker student at University at Buffalo. And they're both here to talk about the Community Responders Pilot Program. The Community Responders are first responders who respond to nonviolent, non-criminal calls without police. Now, there's over 100 American cities that use community responder teams to address low-level health and social needs, which saves police and ambulance times and allows them to respond faster to higher priority calls. Welcome, Colleen and Alia, to the show.
Thanks so much.
Super excited to have you both. And so as we jump in the conversation, I just want to get a little bit of background, right? What inspired the creation of this pilot program for community responders?
I think it was 2020 and the uprising around George Floyd's murder and the national conversation and the national soul searching of how we could possibly do things differently, especially when it comes to mental health crisis. And so here in Buffalo, organizers and advocates started having that conversation and asking that question of, you know, if we didn't have police going to mental health crisis calls or other calls like that, what would we do instead? What would that look like? And so several organizations, including Partnership for the Public Good and Voice Buffalo and Erie County Restorative Justice Coalition, Black Love Resists and the Rest, a few other organizations started meeting, I think, in 2022 to really look at that question.
Yeah, and we've also had instances in Buffalo where there has been some unfortunate incidents where people who have been having a mental health crisis and the police were called, and that situation turned out pretty bad for that person having the mental health crisis. So keeping them in our organizing as well was kind of like the motivation too.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so I know there are a lot of key challenges that have come up, and you know, this program will aim to address those different challenges. Can you talk a little bit about some of those challenges specifically?
Yeah. So when we started, you know, looking into this question in 2022, we started researching around the country what this could look like or what other places were doing. And that's how we learned about community responders and the community responder model. And so we started with the question of how can we take police out of the equation for mental health crisis calls specifically, and from there moved to this understanding of community responders, which is much more proactive and more a much broader scope than that. So community responders in other places go to a wide range of calls, like check welfare, people who are experiencing homelessness, maybe someone sleeping on a park bench or something like that, where it's not even a crisis happening, but there's some sort of underlying health or social need happening. And we started down the path of researching how many calls of that type are in Buffalo that currently go to 911 or go to police. What are the other alternatives that we already have for some of these types of issues? And we really started looking into those questions. So it evolved from just thinking about mental health specifically to really all of the non-emergency, non-violent health and social calls that currently go to police. How could we be handling them differently and looking at how other places are already doing that?
So when you think about reimagining public safety in New York State, you know, what do you think this program really aims to do? And how might the public really understand what's happening?
Yeah. Well, what I really love about the program is there is an element of self-determination. Mm. So within the program, we would be able to train folks within the community that the program would be piloted to be community responders or to just have the skills that they're interested in having, whether it be community health worker skills, skills related to harm reduction, and like things like that everyday person could use in everyday life. So that we feel like is a way to address public safety of communities, keeping communities safe. So that's something we are very excited about.
Yeah, and I can imagine you know, Alia, you'll be doing outreach for the program. And I can imagine in a community where there's folks who might know of folks that have different issues and need a response, that it could be a little bit easier, right, mm-hmm. if they have that relationship. Can you talk a little bit more about that specific relationship and how that might, I guess, you know, reduce some of the issues that might come up?
Yeah, absolutely. It's oftentimes easier to respond to someone who is having a mental health crisis if you know them, mm-hmm. And if you already have some sort of relationship with them and understand, like, why they may be having this sort of reaction, this sort of experience, versus if you don't know them at all. So really taking the strength of a community, which is like the relationship that the communities often already have with each other, and empowering them by, you know, making sure there is trainings and such that people are interested in to be able to respond to these sorts of calls.
And so we hear a lot about like community policing, right? And that's a little bit different than traditional police methods. And so can you just describe that a little bit too, right? Like, how is this different from community policing? And what would be the distinct differences between the two?
Yeah. So community policing, you know, is an approach where police officers are attempting to build relationships with community. And that can be beneficial, you know, when police are trying to solve crimes and are able to, you know, work better with people in the community. The key difference of community responders is that it's a non-police first responder for health and social needs. So it's not about responding to crime. And it's not about, what our current response unfortunately criminalizes those issues. So it's not a crime to have a mental health need. It's not a crime to be addicted to substances, even though that's criminalized. Like, people who have, you know, substance use disorders, currently our approach criminalizes that. But underlying all of those needs, or experiencing homelessness, for example, is someone that just has an unmet health need, right? And so what we currently have by sending police or referring all of those calls into like the legal system is what we have today, where people are sent either to the hospital or jail rather than necessarily getting those underlying needs met. So it's shifting our whole approach to how we respond to those needs by taking that criminalizing element out of the equation and just sending a health professional and a trained peer who can just meet that person where they're at, hear what they're going through, spend the amount of time with them that they need to get to like some of the root causes of what might have precipitated the situation, and even just provide, you know, food right there on site, or warm socks, or take them to maybe a warming station or a shelter or something right then, because unfortunately police are overburdened with all of these calls. It takes away their time from responding to crime, from doing community policing, because they're essentially being asked to be social workers or social service providers, which isn't what their job is supposed to be, but they're being asked to do that type of thing. So it's kind of cutting out the middleman. It's cutting out the police from having to be that connection point and just connecting people with the resources they need right from the get-go.
Yeah, and I like how you described that. It's a healthcare need, right?
Yes.
For a lot of these folks that might be experiencing different challenges, right? In the moment. And
right.
So I know that the report that was released talked about how over 80% of 911 calls to Buffalo police do not involve crime or violence, and yet police are almost always sent, right? And so this addresses to change that dynamic. Alia, you had mentioned harm reduction, and mm-hmm. I know Evergreen Health is one of the partners that will be a part of the coalition. Can you just explain a little bit what harm reduction is for folks and give them a little insight into that?
Yeah. So harm reduction is essentially the first idea of it is to not criminalize folks who are experiencing substance abuse and kind of meeting people at where they are when it comes to the challenges that they're dealing with. But also by providing them with those healthcare needs that they may need right then and there, and also preventing overdoses, right? So making sure that there are test strips available, making sure that there are things like Narcan available for folks who are in having some challenges.
And I think that's helpful for folks to understand there are different ways to kind of approach some of these issues, and a lot of them are often criminalized, to your point, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so can you talk a little bit about just the structure of the pilot program? So we know that there's $100,000 of funding, and that's from New York State to be launching the program. Can you talk a little bit about the structure and how that might be used?
Yeah. So we're still at the point of building out the pilot, planning it, talking to people in the community about it. And so our immediate next steps are to hold some listening sessions. We have three scheduled for December, one December 12th and one December 14th in the Cold Springs, MLK Park, Maston area. With the intent of talking to community members in those areas about community responders, what they are, what they would like to see in a pilot. And our plan for 2025 is to combine all of the feedback to get a very clear plan of what that pilot would look like and use some of that funding to get some of the resources in place to get additional funding to launch a full pilot team. So we're still in early stages and are being very intentional to involve as many people as possible from whatever area the pilot is going to be in.
And how might that feedback from community be used to inform how you dictate what to do with the funds?
Yeah. So like, for example, we are asking questions like, what trainings do you think the community responders should have and kind of like what their day to day should look like and what organizations should be involved? So making sure that the community that we pilot the program in is a part of the pilot, essentially, and the creation of the pilot. So really getting that feedback and implementing it before and during when we actually get things up and running.
That's awesome. So when you think about systemic inequities, right, especially in public safety and mental health responses, what do you think success would look like in changing some of those systemic inequities?
I think in other places that have community responders so far, they've had some really outstanding results. Sometimes people who have been living on the street for 17 years, 20 years have been housed. And that's really due to the relationship building, the amount of time. It's not something where someone shows up one time and that is the outcome, but through repeated contacts and trust building, people are able to get connected with resources that maybe have not been available to them for a long time. Other outcomes really is just people, getting reconnected with the community around them, because so much of the time, I think a lot of us, myself included, don't necessarily know what to do for people in our community who might have needs that extend beyond what we're able to help them with. And unfortunately, right now, like if you call 911, police are almost always sent. And for a lot of situations, where it's not a life-threatening emergency, people don't feel like that's the right response, right? So this adds an additional way for all community members to feel like they can take care of the people around them or help connect people to resources rather than just kind of ignoring some of those issues. So really success would look like. Those relationships being built, people getting connected to the resources that do exist in the community already, but people are just falling through the cracks, you know. But having that personal connection, that person that is able to reach out and maybe give that person a ride many times or give them that bottle of water, that, you know, sandwich every day for 2 weeks in a row, if that's what that person needs, you know, to really make sure that that person is getting that level of personal connection to move to the next step for whatever that person might need.
Yeah, and I think that to add on to that, I think that people in the community just having these skills, whether it be like de-escalation skills and just moving in the city with those skills, is something that really does make me personally feel safe. So having, whether it be young people or elders in our community or folks who are working within the community, very much be equipped to be able to keep the community safe as a whole. Mm-hmm.
And so when you think, you had mentioned, Colleen, how important trust is in building trust in communities. And oftentimes there's a deep-seated mistrust of authority figures in communities, specifically communities of color as well. Mm-hmm. And so can you talk a little bit about how you plan to build trust in these communities, and that be with residents, responders, et cetera? What does that look like for y'all?
Well, I think first by doing the outreach is important. I think a lot of times, unfortunately, in Buffalo, there are like programs and things that just sprout up without enough communication between the people who are creating the program and the people who are going to be most impacted by the program. So that's really why we are heavy on outreach and, you know, knocking doors and hosting listening sessions to get feedback from the community. And also by taking things one step at a time, of course, we are looking to, first start that outreach, of course, and getting that feedback, but making sure that, you know, people aren't taking calls right away, that beforehand, whoever the responders are getting acclimated, will already be acclimated with the community, but are doing their own outreach so that people who would be making those calls know them and are familiar with them and are able to build trust with them before we start, you know, fully hitting the ground running.
Yeah, and our intention, like with the listening sessions and with all of this, is if we hear people say, no, we don't want this, then we won't do it. Like, we're not like, we don't have this plan where we're like, we're rolling this out, tell us what you think, and then we'll decide what we want to do with what you like. It's very much like, you know, who specifically do you want to run this program? Where specifically do you want these responders to be? Like, those are the questions we're asking. And depending on what people say, we'll try to make that happen. You know, what they say that they want. We're going to do our best to design it to what this community says that they want it to be. And then just to the trust question also, like, a lot of the time, so I also have a background in social work, and there is this overemphasis on having a degree, meaning that you are the right person to respond. And that's not true necessarily. There are, you know, benefits to qualifications and credentials, but we really want at least several people on every response to be of and from the community that is being served, and that they, you know, don't necessarily have to have a degree in something. We believe that a lot of the skills like de-escalation, crisis intervention, harm reduction can be taught. And once that person is able to go through that training, it's a lot more important that they have the personal characteristics to be a good responder than necessarily having a certain credential. So that's just an aspect that we feel pretty strongly about and want to definitely incorporate into the design.
Yeah, and I like the fact that you said if the community comes to you and says, you know, this is great, we want this, or we don't, you'll be responsive to that and to that feedback. And so when you think about the structure of the program and say there's calls that are coming in, what do you think in terms of numbers, right? Like, how many people would you be looking to train to be able to de-escalate different situations that might come up?
Yeah. So we want to make our trainings open to the public, but as far as like the details of who would actually be on the team, that's something that, you know, we're working out.
Yeah, like our vision is to offer some of these skills like restorative justice trainings, de-escalation, even community health worker training, like mental health first aid, for example. There's a lot of trainings already being offered around in the community that we would like to, you know, continue to uplift and bring to anyone who wants those skills. Because like Alia said earlier, like if your neighbors have those skills, then you're less likely to necessarily need to call a number to get someone to respond. So we really want those skills and that training to be accessible to everyone. And also by making that sort of a training curriculum, establishing that, we would love to see sort of a pipeline of people who want to become paid community responders sometime in the future, go through those trainings and be ready, you know, when the sort of launch date comes to be paid. Because that is an important thing to say, I think, too, is we envision paid community responders that are equivalent to all other first responders, that they have good pay, good benefits, that it's a career path, you know, for people, not something that's just volunteer or underpaid, because we really believe it's an essential community service. And it's not, I think, for too long, like, social services, human services has been very undervalued in for too long. And we don't want to see that anymore.
Yeah, I think that's a great point too, right? Like compensating folks for doing this type of role. And so when you talk about some of the skill set that's needed, what do you envision that looking like from the community, right? Are there certain skills that might rise to the top in terms of the folks that you'd be looking to kind of incorporate into this program? What does that look like for you?
Well, we would like our community responders to be able to attend like all of the trainings that we would like to offer. But obviously, I think it would be important to have more of like the like healthcare trainings, like the EMT type of trainings, and like de-escalation, of course. And mental health first aid would be really important as well. But even outside of trainings, just like the experience of being among community, at least for me, is like, it's very important, because I feel like if you have that, if you're a personable person, if you're the kind of person who is really looking to care for your community, then the trainings will help. But that, like that personality is essential.
Yeah, and I think we really believe in just rapport building through shared experiences. So peers is a term that can be applied to a lot of different things, but especially like in mental health and substance use, peers are people who have personal experience of recovery or from surviving, you know, crisis situations themselves. And so we also really value that responders who have a lot of empathy based on their own life experience would be able to be in those roles also.
Yeah, I think that makes sense as well, right? If you have that same lived experience and being able to relate, you can approach it in a way that, you know, some folks, if it's police, they might not have that same experience, and that's when escalation can happen. And so when you think about other programs across the country, are there ones that kind of, you know, pop up to the top in terms of how you've learned from them and how you plan to incorporate that into your own program?
Yeah, the kind of the original one that a lot of programs are based off is called CAHOOTS in Eugene, Oregon, and that's been around since 1989. They now operate 24/7. It's an EMT and a trained crisis worker who go to a really wide variety of calls, like check welfare, mental health, assist public. Those are sort of like the call codes, but they go to, I think, over 20,000 calls a year. They're very busy. and just have a really stellar track record when it comes to community support and community trust. And also in those, you know, 35 plus years, haven't had a death or a serious injury ever. So it's a really impressive track record. They also save the local hospital system something like $14 million a year in reduced emergency room visits, and save the local police department several million dollars a year by reducing the number of calls that are going to police. So that's kind of the original. But since 2020, there's been hundreds of programs. Well, hundreds is an overestimate. There's about 100 total. So dozens of programs have popped up in the last 4 years. One of my personal favorites is in Durham, North Carolina. It's called HEART, H-E-A-R-T. And that's a peer clinician and an EMT. And they also go to many, many calls. And I guess the reason I really like that is just their program is their approach. They call people neighbors, not clients, and they really just report meaningful interactions that they've had with people. So, for example, like they there was someone that was living in a parking garage and was reported to be acting kind of mean towards people that were walking through the parking garage. And so they went there day after day and talked to him and built this relationship with him. And I mean, ultimately, he just, you know, listened to what they were saying and found somewhere else to live. It wasn't honestly like a revolutionary kind of in change, but just the way that you that they report some of these things is so humanizing compared to some of what we're more used to seeing, where it's sort of clinical and it's sort of like the professionals came and helped the client and then XYZ thing happened. It's more of a community-based approach, for example. There's other programs. There's one in Denver called STAR. They've been operating for 4 years. They've never had to call police for backup, never had an arrest happen. There's so many. There's I could go on and on. But yeah, some really amazing outcomes from around the country.
Awesome. And we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with what's next.
Our mission at Buffalo Toronto Public Media is to serve our local community. And on WBFO, we do that by keeping you informed. We bring you important perspectives from your neighbors on what's next.
It's cultural heritage tourism. People go and they travel different places to learn about history and live experiences that only took place in that area. Oftentimes you may have people in certain positions that don't understand the value of cultural heritage tourism.
And we investigate issues in our community, such as racial disparities and traffic stops.
The data breakdown by council district shows that Black people are stopped disproportionately to their population in all 9 districts. Lovejoy District leads the pack in terms of those disproportionate stops. Just 37% of the district's population is Black, yet Black motorists account for almost 70% of stop receipts issued there.
This is Public Media.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
You're listening to What's Next. I am your guest host, Ekua Menzedu of Clementine Gold Group, and we're joined with Colleen Christich, Senior Community Researcher at Partnership for the Public Good, and Alia Williams, Social Worker student at University at Buffalo. And so when we talk about this program, I want to get a little bit personal with both of you, right, in terms of why you thought to join this, what excites you about the program. And so is there a particular moment or story that really solidified your belief in the importance of this community responder program?
Yeah. So for me, I have had members of my family who have, and friends who have had mental health crises in the past. And there have been cases where I was like their first interaction. And in that moment, it's often difficult, especially considering the fact that those people are oftentimes were Black males, and having fear of, you know, calling the police and had them having a bad interaction with the police, and feeling like there is ultimately like no safe option to address their situation in the moment. So for me, that makes me personally really excited about the program, because having people in the community responding to family members and friends who may be having a mental health crisis makes me feel a lot safer compared to having police who may not be trained in the trainings that we're offering.
Yeah, similar for me. I think I'm thinking of a time a couple years ago. I had a close friend who was not in a good place, and we knew was out on the street of Buffalo, just not, she wasn't homeless, but just was not in a good place. And we were concerned about her just like wandering around. And at that time, it was like 10 p.m. or something. I called couple resources that, you know, are currently available, and long story short, ended up being told like, well, if you can find her, you can take her to the hospital. It's like, okay, like not ultimately that helpful, honestly. And that's not to put any shade or anything on any of the current existing programs that we have, but it's an example of the disconnect between when you need an in-person immediate response. That option does not currently exist outside of 911. And honestly, even if you call 911, even if you do want the police to respond, they are not able to necessarily get there right then for an issue that isn't like immediately life-threatening, right? So it's all of the current things that we have on offer are trying their best, but we really need community responders, and I feel this, you know, regularly because there isn't that non-criminalizing healthcare-based first response for all of these situations that come up over and over again. Just other ones that come to mind, I was driving not that long ago, and there was a man in the street, clearly, you know, intoxicated or something, you know, going on, and was, you know, in harm's way. I was concerned about him, but also thought to myself at that time, I wish there were community responders that I could call. So once you kind of know about this and you know what's happening in other places, you start to recognize over and over again, like, oh, I wish I had a community responder to call. And that happens to me now probably every 2 or 3 months. Yeah. So it's something that I think we really need as soon as possible.
And so you think about, you know, some of the things that happen out in the community, right? And you might see someone who's having a mental health crisis at that moment. When you think about some of the news stories that have come out, right? I think about in Buffalo, there's been certain situations, Rochester, I can think about Daniel Prude, mm-hmm. and, you know, some of the unfortunate outcomes and devastating outcomes that have happened. And so folks read these news, like the headlines, right? And see, oh my gosh, there was this incident that happened. We wish that there were someone that we could call that could have approached the situation differently. Mm-hmm. I often read comments in comment section, which, you know, we probably shouldn't.
It's so tempting.
You know, it's always tempting. Yeah. And there's a lot of folks that don't understand the need for some of this de-escalation. And so outside of those headlines, what do you hope people really can glean from this program?
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope that people can take away the concept that communities take care of themselves. I think that in a lot of communities, especially communities of color here in Buffalo, there is this strength of like relationship and really like caring for one another. It's just a matter of being resourced the way that those communities need to be resourced. And I think that if a community responders team was to be able to happen in some of those communities and be successful, then it'll be another example of just how important it is to resource communities so they can be able to have that self-determination and care for one another.
Yeah. And to your point about, you know, crisis situations and when they happen and, you know, high profile incidents happen, what I really want people to know is that that's, there's no reason why it has to get to that point. Mm-hmm. If we had community responders, that there could be a much more proactive, much earlier intervention. That's really where community responders shine, is that it does not have to rise to the level of a crisis for community responders to be sent. It doesn't have to be an emergency. It can just be, you know, a low level need where someone's concerned about someone. That's really our vision, is to have community responders be so much a part of the landscape, so much a part of the first response system, that when you call, you can get that response and get that person the care they need before it escalates into a crisis, before someone feels like they need to call 911 even. And if we had that, I think we would see a lot fewer of those incidents happening at all.
So talk to the skeptic that might hear this and say, okay, this sounds great, but, you know, we really know that police are necessary in every incident that pops up, right? What would you tell them as it relates to the program?
Well, I think for one is working in other cities, and there's a lot of success in other cities, some cities that are even in size and to a certain extent in nature, very similar to Buffalo. So it's not like it's a concept that's new. And also there are like strengths that we have identified in certain communities that we may want to pilot in, that we really feel are perfect to make sure the pilot is successful.
Yeah, to Alia's point, I mean, it's working in places like that are much bigger and arguably have even more intense or violent situations, like Chicago, San Francisco, New York City, like some large cities have successful non-police first responder programs like this. And also Los Angeles, the Los Angeles Police Union liked this idea so much and like the program that was operating in Los Angeles so much that they said, hey, actually, we want non-police, you know, civilian responders to take over all these other calls. Like, here's 23 calls that we think we should not be the first response for, you know, and we want to see. So they held a press conference. This was the police union and said, we want civilian responders. And so I think that's probably one of the strongest testaments is in a lot of places where these programs exist. Police are the number one fan. They'll tell you, we don't want to be responding to these calls over and over again. We don't feel like we have the resources to actually offer when we're there. And so they, Cahoots, for example, which is the longest running one, has a lot of support from the local police and a very good working relationship. So it definitely can work. And it's just, yeah, a matter of like getting the infrastructure set up.
And so can you describe, you mentioned like 23 specific calls that the LA police, LAPD said that they didn't want to respond to. Can you describe some of those? I know we talked about some mental health crises. What else is on that list for them?
Yeah, there's a lot of these calls in Buffalo, too. People call 911 for all sorts of things. Some of them, it's noise complaints. It's kids skipping school. It's littering. It's cars parked the wrong place. Like, these are some of the ones that, like, the LA police were saying, like, we don't want to respond to abandoned vehicles and fireworks and garbage being dumped on empty lots. Like, these are not emergencies, you know. For community responders specifically, it's more about the health and social calls. So any type of call that's related to, that doesn't involve violence and isn't life-threatening, that's related to mental health, substance use, someone experiencing homelessness, public intoxication, non-emergency medical needs like wound care, for example, like people who are unhoused, you know, sometimes might have a minor wound, but without that ongoing care can become like a hospitalization unnecessarily, you know. So some of these teams are doing sort of regular low-level medical care. Really just anything related to conflict resolution where it's an argument or some type of noise or verbal sort of conflict where there's no violence, but there is some type of conflict going on. In Buffalo, I think that that's over like 13% of the calls to 911 are just like neighbor dispute, customer dispute, landlord dispute, just people having arguments where a mediator could go a long way. Yeah.
And so when you think about, you know, some of these wraparound services that'll be necessary, right, you'll be dispatched to a specific community and there's something that's going on. What do you envision that partnership looking like for the coalition, right? There'll be a lot of different folks that are involved, or you'll have resources that you can give out to those folks that might need help?
Yeah, I think we envision, you know, partnering with, you know, local shelters and local businesses as well. Pretty much everybody who is kind of like a stakeholder in that community, so that one, they know that the pilot exists and that they can use it whenever, but two, that if there are, you know, more long-term needs that the folks who are need to be making these calls need to be connected with, or we're able to say, hey, okay, you can go to this business here, or you can go to this shelter here, and be able to get the care that we may not be able to provide.
Yeah, it's definitely about being that connector. So the community responder is a first responder. They go in person right away and they, you know, do what they can on scene. But then it is a really key part to have that referral network in place, to have those community partnerships built so that the person can have a warm handoff or be connected, you know, as soon as possible with whatever it is that they might need, the healthcare or the long-term sort of case management type of thing. All of those resources are available already. So it's really about the community responder is the glue. It's the connector that just connects those dots for people.
And so, you know, when you talk about folks calling 911, right, it's also a really easy number to memorize. And so you have 911. I think there's 211 for information. There's 311 for different community concerns. Will there be a specific number that it's easy for folks to remember, or will it go through 311? Can you describe what that might look like?
That's the hope. We have like different stages of our pilot. So it may look like your standard, you know, 7-digit number to start off, and it may look like, you know, connecting with the 311, 211, 911 in the future.
Yeah. I'm glad that you asked that question, too, because what we're envisioning to start out is something that's extremely manageable. We feel really strongly that the quality of the response is so important that we want to start with something that we know can be very successful. So starting small, like Alia said, probably starting with like a 7-digit phone number. But we also are very clear that we have this grand vision that eventually anywhere in Erie County, if you call 211, 311, 988, 911, if this is an issue that is appropriate for community responders, you would get a community responder within 30 minutes, 24 hours a day. That's our grand vision. And so it's going to take time before we're there. But that we really want it to be something that is the equivalent of all of the other first responders someday.
Great. And we're going to take one more break and we'll come back with the rest of the conversation.
Our mission at Buffalo Toronto Public Media is to serve our local community. And on WBFO, we do that by keeping you informed and connected to your community, whether it's by hearing from a local Black poet about what it was like to move from the inner city to the suburbs on What's Next.
So that emotional change with that culture change combined led me realize that basketball and being physical wasn't enough. I needed a way to figure out my emotions. So the first poem I wrote in the cafetorium of Sweet Home Middle School was Outcast.
Or it's exploring the East Side Garden Walk.
It's wonderful that we're seeing engagement in beautification and sharing gardens, because we believe that we can build more vibrant communities by sharing our gardens, by sharing our stories, and by building real connections between people. We came through as neighbors and cleaned this space out and began plot by plot putting plants in.
This is Public Media.
Hey people, Corey here with Compaq Civics. If you're from Western New York, you know snow. And unfortunately, you know how damaging those annoying potholes can be. But do you know what's involved in filling those potholes so your car tires can stay intact? Let me put you on. because maintaining roads involves way more than the average citizen might think. Cities, counties, and states take part in this process. Why, you might ask? Well, a state might be responsible for filling potholes and paving, but a city handles snow plowing and de-icing. These responsibilities are shared among elected officials, road managers, supervisors, and other essential personnel, all so you can drive safely. Try and imagine a city or town without a public works department. No one to manage public buildings like schools or hospitals, or maintain infrastructure we rely on, like roads, bridges, and airports. Can't forget about essential public services like water and sewage. And when those summer months hit, you can forget about public spaces we enjoy, like parks and beaches. We deserve these spaces, and our taxes pay for it all. So, next time you drive across a smooth road or see a snowplow clearing one, appreciate it. Public works are the backbone of what keep our communities and quality of life thriving.
Special thanks to our partners, the Buffalo Presidential Center, whose mission is to explore and share stories about Buffalo and Western New York's contributions to the U.S. presidency and national affairs.
Looking for an award-winning original series to binge? Buffalo Toronto Public Media has something for everyone. Check out Brave Spaces, Compact History, and Let's Go at WNED.org or on the BTPM YouTube channel.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
You're listening to What's Next. I am guest host Ekua Menzedu, and we are with Colleen Christich and Alia Williams. And so, Alia, you talked about some of the outreach that you'll be doing. I can imagine that, you know, there'll need to be more communication externally to folks just to let them know that this exists, right? Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about what that looks like and the education that'll go behind that?
Yeah. Well, first things first, starting with knocking on people's doors and, you know, doing some canvassing in the community and just letting people know what the program is and then getting the feedback at the door. We are looking to do surveys to ask like a few questions, things like what trainings would you like to have if this model was created, and what organizations would you like to have involved in this model? So really making sure that education is like mutual, and that we're getting some feedback from the community while also telling them about the pilot as well.
Awesome. And when you think about the broader implications and what the success could look like for this program, what do you think the ripple effects this program could have on other systems, right? We think about housing, education, healthcare. What comes up for you there?
Probably the most immediate effects would be on the 911 system itself and the number of calls that currently go in. We talked earlier about really 911 is used for everything under the sun because it's the resource that people know, and it is the way to get a fast in-person response. So a decrease in the number of calls going to 911 would be one impact because they would be going to this more appropriate response first for health and social needs. Also for hospitalizations and healthcare costs, a lot of folks are familiar, I think, that the ER system is overused too much. People just end up going to the emergency room because of a lack of alternatives. Fortunately, I know there is a crisis stabilization center, hopefully opening soon on Niagara Street, which would be a 24-hour alternative to the hospital. But having community responders who are able to provide some care on site and to stabilize people in the community, I think would also, and in other places, has impacted the hospital system. So those two are immediate ones. I think also incarceration, like too many people with unmet mental health and substance use needs end up in jail for often low-level charges that don't need to end up there. If they had their needs met much earlier in the community, I think we would see a decrease in the jail population also.
And so you're coming from the Partnership for Public Good, and oftentimes we talk about advocacy and public policy that the organization is shaping and forming. And so what do you think from a public safety standpoint and norm, you know, in Buffalo and beyond, how could this reshape policy for folks?
Actually, yeah, I'm glad that you asked that, because the other day I was reading about how the city of Buffalo is spending many millions of dollars on police and fire overtime because we only have 911 and because police and fire are the default response for everything. And AMR, actually, the ambulance system, is having the same issues where lower level non-emergency calls are getting the same that response, are getting police or fire or an ambulance, even when those aren't necessarily the best response. So I see it as one, if we had community responders and really having the trained community members and the right responder for those calls, we could definitely save some money on those systems, on overtime, especially for those systems. A lot of places have seen that. Like in going back to CAHOOTS in Oregon again, because that's the longest studied one, the CAHOOTS program costs like $2 million a year. In Buffalo, we spend over $90 million on police. So it's a huge cost difference in what it takes to run some of these programs. So that would be one way, I think, that it would benefit everyone to have a more appropriate response for some of these calls.
And I know a lot of folks will be excited to hear about cost savings, right? And especially when times are a little bit tighter for governments and communities as a whole. And so when you think about, I know you mentioned Oregon and the CAHOOTS program. Do you have any of the stats around how much they've been able to save at that level or any other program? Put you on the spot.
I know. I do. It's in our report, which is on our website, ppgbuffalo.org. The report's called Bringing Community Responders to Erie County. I remember the CAHOOTS program reports that they saved the hospital system $14 million a year and reduced emergency room savings. And I can't remember the police savings off the top of my head, but it's in the millions. It's in the millions. Yeah.
Every year. When you think about that type of support from governments, what does that look like, right? What would you be asking governments to do?
Well, first off, the program, that's something that, you know, is obviously necessary, especially for it to be sustainable and for people to be paid a livable wage and have the benefits that they deserve. But as far as the impact of the program, also, I do think, you know, I think about the trainings in the way social workers are taught in the education system. And I think that our model and some of the trainings that we outlined aren't even given or highly present in social worker education. So also impacting the way like healthcare, whether it be mental health care or physical health care, workers do their job as well and are educated as well, is something that I think will come true after the program is piloted.
And so if you think about success, right, if the pilot succeeds, what would be your vision, both of you, right, your vision for the next 5 years for the program?
Well, it being one citywide and it going to, the calls going to a number like 311-211-911, and of course having sustainable funding, but also the people in the city and in the county having those trainings and knowing about the resources and feeling more safe and being able to and know that they're able to have a fourth response that is not a police response, that is not a fire response, would look like a success.
Yeah, I think in 5 years, I would love to see the whole city of Buffalo have community responders 24 hours a day. That would be achievable and exciting goal, I think. Yeah.
And so where can folks learn a little bit more about the program and how can they get involved?
So our report is on ppgbuffalo.org, bringing bringing community responders to Erie County. The Community Responders for Erie County Coalition, which Alia and I are part of, along with several other organizations, we have a link tree. It's linktree.com/community-responders4EC. And that's where we post updates and invitations to the flyers for the listening sessions that are coming up. The listening session on December 12th is for Cold Springs and Maston Park, MLK Park area. That's December 12th at the Johnny B. Wiley Center, 5 o'clock, mm-hmm. right? Yeah, yep. 5 o'clock. And then December 14th, same community, that's a Saturday at noon, December 14th at Beverly Gray. Mm-hmm. So, please come to those sessions if you're in those neighborhoods.
Awesome. And so thank you. I want to thank you both for coming on to What's Next. This has been a conversation with Colleen Christich, Senior Community Researcher at Partnership for the Public Good, and Alia Williams, Social Worker student at University at Buffalo. Thank you both for coming on.
Thank you. Thanks for having us. Mm-hmm. Great to be here.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.